You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi! This is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about the tingly, heart-stopping, mic-drop moments that led you to becoming an artist. Pamela Muller-Karaman is the executive director of the Neighborhood Playhouse School of Theater. Just a few of their alumni includes Tony Randall, Mary Steenburgen, Robert Duvall, Jasmine Septis-Jones, Gregory Peck, Christopher Lloyd, Chris Noth, Dylan McDermott, Allison Janney, Joanne Woodward, and on and on and on. For more than two decades, Pamela has taught the Meisner technique in New York, and she continues to nurture generations of actors. The school just reopened at their famed Red Doors for in-person classes in September. Welcome!
Well, thank you. Welcome. I was getting goosebumps listening to your intro with our alumni. It's astonishing. It's astonishing when you hear it in a list like that. I'm so proud.
It is astonishing. And it's astonishing that you've been the executive director since 2012, right?
Yes. Wow. I know. Wow.
And I think about, it's incredible what Gregory Peck said, actors who came out of the Neighborhood Playhouse changed a great deal about American acting. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. It's true in the sense that I think at that time when Gregory Peck was there, which was, you know, in the early days of it, I think he graduated in the early 40s, mid 40s probably. But the whole idea of what is good acting, as we know, was changing. And we had the group theater came in the 30s, and all of the great acting teachers that came out of that, one of whom, of course, was Sanford Meisner. And they were on such a journey for truth in acting. Of course, they were descendant of Stanislavski, but more specific in the American quality is that And I think it's still true today. You know, people have high expectations of authentic, truthful behavior in acting. There's no more presentational acting. There's no neck-up acting. There's no heady vocal acting. Although you need a wonderful voice to support your instrument and be a good actor, everyone knows that we're talking about real truth. So what Gregory Peck meant, I think, and I'm sure you feel it, Gerald, sometimes you go to a film or a play and you feel like a fly on the wall. You feel embarrassed that you're watching what you're watching because it's so pure, it's so truthful, and yet it's not remotely a documentary. It's high, high art. So many of our graduates, and today as well, that's what they're doing. They're seeking the ability to live truthfully under imaginary circumstances. Now, that was Mr. Meisner's so-called definition. People have usurped it and use it. That's fine with me because everyone knows that it's true. It's really about living truthfully. The only thing imaginary is the circumstances. The life of it is remarkably authentic. And so that's a difficult task. And I think he's right. Yeah.
And it's beautiful that all these decades that legacy has continued.
Absolutely.
And you carried the torch. What would you like people to know about the Neighborhood Playhouse?
The Neighborhood Playhouse, you know, is often the students who come out of there, myself included, 1,000 years ago, say it best. But yeah, one student recently, his name is actually Ian Duff. He's a wonderful, talented graduate. He graduated 5 years ago, possibly six, but I think five. And I once asked him, and he said, "The Neighborhood Play. You have to experience the Neighborhood Playhouse. To it just is. And once you walk in there, you become a part of it." And I think what he meant by that is an enormous community, a commitment to training and high art, really. And it is a very special place. There's lots of conservatories. They all are wonderful. We're training young actors. We want to continue to do that. But the Playhouse has always had a really kind of solid community homely feeling. You mentioned the red doors. They're still there. They're new ones now because we have been renovating and they're gorgeous, but they're red and they, you know, you walk through them and you're in that world where it's acceptable to work really hard on becoming an actor. And the rest of the world doesn't really always support that. You know, sometimes your parents or your friends or relatives say, what do you want to be? What are you going to be? Huh? How are you going to make a living? You walk in the door here and we celebrate that that's who you are and what you want to be. So I think it's what I want people to know is it's very serious. It's for very serious minded people. It's also very joyful because there's great joy in hard work. We all know that. You know it every day. And that it is a community, a warm community. You mentioned Gregory Peck and many other of our illustrious grads. You become part of that legacy in that family. And you get to stand on the same stage where Diane Keaton did her first scene. And you're going to do your first scene. So there's something pretty cool about that. Welcoming, very welcoming.
And I love the full circle-ness of it because you're an alum. From there. So can you talk about your lightning strikes moment? What led you to becoming an artist?
You know, I thought when I knew the interview was coming up and I love your title. I love it. And I love it in my position now as executive director because it's so great for students and would-be, wannabe young seekers of acting to realize everyone who they admire and look at had a beginning, had a lightning strike, gave themselves permission to be this person who they are. And it may have been a hard hit or it may have been a soft hit, but it's lightning strikes was so great. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it. And I want to say, in my case, I think I was always, as a youngster, seeking, and it was like water finding a crack in rock or something. I would find places through and say, and kind of go, oh, wait a minute. And I was really fortunate to grow up in a teeny tiny town in Long Island, a place called Remsenburg, which is a funny little burg. It's right near the Hamptons, but I would live there all year round. So in the wintertime, there are about 300 people there. In the summertime, there was a huge explosion of, you know, summer people. But many of the people who lived there, unbeknownst to me, were kind of creatives. And P.G. Woodhouse, the fabulous, you know, creator of Jeeves. He lived down the road. Yeah. And he would walk his dogs. He's a great lover of dogs. And you probably know that he gave all the money to begin and to continue the Bidowie, you know, dog rescue shelters were all because of him. And I love the term, I'm getting off now, but Bidowie, I didn't know what that meant. And I remember saying to my mother, why is it called Bidowie? And she knew nothing, no reason that she would know. And she wasn't English. And she said, oh, it's a place where dogs stay. And then I looked it up somehow it means stay a while. And I just went, oh my goodness. So I would see him walking his dogs and knew he was cuckoo and creative and different than my parents and my family. And I was like, so attracted, certainly didn't talk to him or anything there. So I then got a job when I got old enough, I got a job as a nanny for these summer people would come in. And I was a perfect young teenage nanny. And, I got a job with a family who were delightful. They had lovely little girls and I worked for them a lot, like, you know, 5 days a week. Well, they enjoyed the summer. And the grandmother of the family was a director of Italian speaking theater. The grandfather, who was deceased when I met them, had been the librarian, he was in charge of the music at Radio City Music Hall. These jobs just fascinated me. And I was a little crack into a world that I had no idea why I wanted to be in it, but I certainly did. I wanted to find out more of how, wow, there's another life out there where people create and do these interesting things. You know, you didn't have the internet. I didn't have theater per se, very little movies, but I think what you started earlier when we were talking about instincts and impulses in the intro, yeah, I had that. I was seeking something. I was seeking self-expression, probably. So these lovely people introduced me to this family. They brought me to the theater. I saw dance companies. Eventually, et cetera. But here's the fun, the sort of lightning. The storm was brewing, and the lightning was coming, and it's come, and it keeps on coming. But one of my friends' father, and they were again summer people, and I was not. I lived there all the time. His father was the chairman of the board of Pepsi Cola. Now, you might say, okay, what's that have to do with it? His name was Herb Barnett, a lovely guy. And one of the board members of Pepsi-Cola was Joan Crawford. Now, people don't realize this, but
yes.
Joan, yes. Yes. Remember, she was married
Mommy
to Mr.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Steele was her husband for a brief time, and he was a big mucky-muck at Pepsi. And when he died, she joined the board. And she refused to get off the board, is the story, but she joined the board.
There's that scene in, Mommy Dearest, where she's at the head of the conference table.
So Herb Barnett, who took a liking to me, and he wanted me to follow my dreams, and he wanted me to find out more about being in the theater. He said, I'm going to set up a phone call with you and Joan. And I was like, 18 years old. I said, Joan Crawford? And he said, yes, I want her to talk to you. And so Joan, I'm laughing. It was endearing and wonderful. And it definitely was lightning strikes in the sense that I was speaking to an expert, maybe, and again, Mommy Dearest had not been out yet, but, yeah. But baby, whatever happened to Baby Jane had, was not, me as a youngster at the time, I was like, wow, this is a formidable gal. She called me. Her assistant called. My mother answered the phone and said, Joan Crawford's on the phone for you. And she began to tell me how very difficult this is. Don't think this is glamorous. If you really want to be an actress, you need to work really hard. You need to understand you're going to get up at 5 a.m. I mean, she was making a list like I was joining the army. And I still found myself excited. I wasn't getting turned off at all. I was getting thrilled. And then she said, you have to go to the neighborhood playhouse. That's the only place to go. And I'm going to call Sanford Meisner and make an appointment for you. And so, I was fortuitous, right place at the right time, right people, supportive people. So that was a huge moment for me. And my parents wanted me to go to college, of course, as all parents do. And I went for one semester and then begged out. I said, please, can I follow what Miss Crawford had in mind? And I went to meet Mr. Meisner, and then lightning really struck for me in that I had never met a bona fide artist and sat down in conversation. He took a great interest in me in a way that I found astonishing. And I felt like we were speaking a language that even though I'd never studied it, I seemed to know it very well. And I'm sure you can relate to that. Suddenly I was with the right tribe and I was very excited. So that was all the water seeking through the rocks and the lovely people I met and all set next, there I was in his office. And then to jump ahead a little bit, the wild thing is that when I graduated the Neighborhood Playhouse, I must have written him a note of thanks. I don't recall that, but I must have. And because I, not long ago, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I found a letter from him that it was an answer to my letter. So obviously I'd thanked him and he was writing a note. And I was now, when I found this, the executive director of the Neighborhood Playhouse, who would have, it was just crazy. So, and in the letter he said, now comes the future. May it bring you a happy and fulfilling career. And I looked at that and I thought, I'm sitting in your office and the future has come and gone and come and gone. As you know, you live long enough, there's a lot of futures and they come and go. Mm-hmm. And so something really, the lightning that struck along the way, the Neighborhood Playhouse was really a serious home for me. And to be back again in this position is just right for me. I think, just pretty, I'm committed and passionate about everything that goes on there. And I'm just thrilled that it's all, that I'm there still and that we're opening after the pandemic, as you say, So that's a long strike, but there was the lightning of being an artist and finding that people do this and how do you do it? And then the lightning along the way until finally walking in those red doors myself and not knowing ever that I would be there again at this age, but thank goodness.
But what a beautiful confluence of events, dare I say, Ms. Crawford recommending you.
Yeah.
To Sandy Meisler, and then him taking you on. I love all those pieces. Can you put into words, is it hard to articulate what it was when you were sitting in his office that made you think, this is my tribe? Was there something he said or did, or what was it about that experience, that first moment?
Great question. Great question. There was a depth to it that I didn't find in life. I'm not sure what your life was like as a youngster, but there was a depth to the conversation about why I wanted to do, what did I think, what were my expectations. They weren't black and white answers. It was a conversation about the meaning of art in the world and how I saw myself. And I was not intimidated or inhibited. I found myself suddenly answering. You know, he was so, he was serious. He was debonair. He had a lovely sense of humor. And I think the fact that that we were talking about art as, and he was including me in it, you know, I think what he felt was, if you're sitting here and you're seeking this, you are this, you know, why would you be here? And I suddenly, that struck me that I think I am. And I think he recognized it. So that moved me, and I left flying on air. But I mean, again, don't you think you actors are born? We know that, and then they're either nurtured or not. And many people, it doesn't, you know, because I interview people as you do. I interview young people who want to come, and they all say, "This is the most comfortable I am. The facade isn't working." You know, I think in life we have a facade. And we keep it up, and we, oh, lovely day, nice hair, how are you? Nice. There's a kind of thing, and actors and artists, I think, want a deeper connection to you know, what does it mean to be here and be human and answer these questions through art. And I know I certainly had that and didn't know I did, but he struck a chord with me by asking me these questions, and I went, wow, I think I know the answers.
What was that like for you going through the program?
I had been a loner and self-conscious. I came from a little bit of a dysfunctional family, and I'm sure many artists and many people you interview do. My imagination was, you know, my best friend, and that little teeny town again that I refer to. I got on my bike, and there were in the wintertime, you know, you could ride down the middle of the street, you know, and be alone with your, and in my case, imagination, not really thoughts, imagination, let it run wild. And just stories and the people that I would meet, and I would make up stories about them and so on. So when I got to the Playhouse and people wanted that part of me, they wanted to nurture that part of me, my imagination and my creativity. It was like, again, I keep using this word and I mean it, sort of being home and being valued. So what I learned there about authenticity, and I will say Meisner, as I said, was a bona fide artist. I really knew that. And he was one of the most first authentic people I met. He, you know, he really was who he was. Like that felt good, like meat and potatoes way. This is it. You know what I mean? There's no need for a facade or so once when I left there, or when I studied there and got more and more free, you know, you become really free when you become unselfconscious. Your artistic mm-hmm. self starts guiding you, and your impulses and your instincts, you trust them and follow them, as opposed to suppressing them and hiding them. And you know what I mean? Which I think in my family had been the case. I mean, there was, again, not to overemphasize, this long time ago, and everyone did the best they could, but it was a pretty wacky family. Mm-hmm. And nobody was particularly interested in art or in anything that would, anything expressive, really. You didn't express. A lot of secrets, you know, a lot of quiet, don't talk about it things. So here you could, and he, you know, he and all the other teachers, I mean, Mary Steenburgen recently, she's a good friend of mine. She was in my era there. She was a class behind me. We're still great friends. And she said, you know, you could never go on this journey that we've all been on alone. It's the teachers and the community. And that was it. Yeah, that it was a profound experience for me. And I think it is for many, many people who come through the doors. And it was a very necessary one for me. I would have probably, yeah, I'm sure I would have, I don't know what I would have done. So I hate to sound so dramatic, but there's a truth to it. In finding your true self and admitting it, standing tall and saying, yes, I'm this. I think I'm an artist. That was a pretentious phrase where I came from. People didn't want to hear it.
People didn't want to hear it.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
How incredible that you were able to step out of your comforts or from what you knew and say, I'm an artist. And you became a very prolific director as well. Yeah. And you are a very prolific director. How did that happen? How did you get into directing?
I was, again, very fortunate in the people that I met and the things that I did. I had a relationship, a nice relationship with Michael Wilding, who happens to be Elizabeth Taylor's son, and his lovely wife, Brooke Palance. And we worked together a little bit, and then we had a lot of great talks and meetings, and we decided to form a company here in New York when we were young, and it was called Acorn Productions. And we started to do plays, and I was still acting in them then, and we were hiring directors and producing, and really terrific, you know, hard work, you know, nose to the grindstone artist, and they both were hungry for that as well. And during that time, I started thinking more seriously about directing. Somebody said to me, you know, I got fired once from a really crummy little off thing, and somebody said, yeah, because you talk too much and you're ahead of the director. Maybe you should direct. And I was like, I want to be an actress. And then I realized, no, I actually am a director. And I want to jump back for a second. Before Acorn, when I first got out of school, again, Mary Steenburgen, who was a dear friend, she and I started a comedy group. And the comedy group was an improv comedy, and improv comedy right at the same time as Saturday Night Live was being born, you know. And we had a great time. We had three other graduates from the school, and we started working. And I was the director, and we all wrote things. And we started working for the Bureau of Alcoholism, believe it or not. And we worked at halfway houses to entertain people who were trying to get sober. So the audiences were, you know, somewhat appreciative, and it was wild. And so that's when I really started taking the helm of directing, and with Acorn, when we started doing plays, did it more. And then another very fortunate thing is that a lovely woman who named Leandra Pope in Westchester, who owned and bought an old schoolhouse, decided she saw one of our shows of Acorn, and I forget exactly when, and she said, I want to bring theater to my schoolhouse. I want to make a theater out of my schoolhouse. And lo and behold, we brought a play up there. It was Brooke and Michael were in it. It was Bedroom Farce, actually. Bedroom Farce was the first play we did up there. And I was in it. I didn't direct it. I acted in it. But my relationship with her grew. And I spent over 20 years creating wonderful equity theater with Leandra Pope as the producer owner. She was more than that. She was like a benefactor, really, for me. She just loved and nurtured my directing talent, and I made the opposite commute for a long time, driving up from New York, and we created a wonderful, wonderful theater. The New York Times loved us and said terrific things, and I just got to hone my skills.
Yeah, that was the Schoolhouse Theater.
Yeah,
we were, right?
Yeah,
and also the cabaret, the improv troupe. Was that with the Manhattan Theater?
Yes, with Mary Steenburgen, where she was discovered. I mean, big time discovered. But we did lunchtime theater at St. Peter's Theater, at the St. Peter's Theater, which is still there on 54th Street. Then they had a little lunchtime thing. They loved us. They had us in there. people would bring a brown bag and watch improv. And again, this is early 70s when all that was starting to happen. So different. Uh-huh. And Manhattan Theater Club people came, Lynn Meadow, and they said, do you want to come? We want you to be the resident cabaret company at the, and they were on 73rd Street in those days between 1st and 2nd in an old building where a Mason Union building. This is way when they were first starting. So we were there on the week, like Thursday, Friday, Saturday night in their cabaret. So you'd go see, and in those, I mean, they did Crimes of the Heart was done there, and then come over and see us. And we were great. We were funny, and we were all like, you know, improvising and creating this wacky world. Yeah, I forgot about that. I didn't forget it, but there you go. Mm-hmm. That was Crack Tokens, and that was the beginning again of me. I really did. So then I pulled away from the performing once Crack Tokens, and then I just directed. And I've just been so fortunate, and I love it. I really do love it, and I never think back about acting anymore. I think I'd die. This is making me nervous enough to even talk with you. I want to be back behind the scenes. Yeah.
What does directing give you? You said you love to talk. I mean, how does it fulfill you as an artist?
Oh, so much. When you read a play that you have a feel for, and it just flows over you in that way. That, I mean, actors do the same thing, but in a different way, because they're usually just reading their part. You know, I love interpreting the what's written, and I love working hard to make sure I am. One of my great philosophies about directing is I'm not imposing myself. I'm exposing and creating this play. I'm not trying to make it, you know, my vision, but not at the expense of the artist who wrote this and I love collaborating with that script, whether, you know, not, I may not meet the author per se, but the script, it feeds me. And then to guide the actors and help everybody be in the same play. Now, this may make sense to you, and I bet it does because you're a big theater lover. Sometimes you go to a play, and everyone's wonderful, but they're sort of each one in a different play. There's something happening. Or the other thing I often see, or they're all playing versions of the same part. Do you know what I mean? I really love to help people strengthen their point of view and understand that they are very different characters in this play, and that this play is not their life or what they want to do or what they it's and yes, you are working from your instincts, but you're working off the author, and you are bringing yourself to this because it was written to be acted. If it wasn't, we could all sit down and read it and have a discussion. That's not the case. So taking it off the page, they often need guidance, not so much, you have to stay out of the way, but some. And then we all get to make this fantastic, when you hold a play in your hand from Dramatist Play Service or Samuel French or whatever, and then you're looking at it, there comes a day quite quickly in rehearsal where you put it, you don't need that. And then you watch the play you just created with these other wonderful people, lighting designer, costume designer, everyone. And like, it didn't exist a couple of weeks ago. It was a piece of paper. I find it thrilling.
Isn't that magical?
Yes. Matt, you see,
when
magical
you create
is
a world.
A world where it wasn't. Yes. It wasn't. There was no one here last night.
Yeah, it was a ghost light. And I love that you directed for 59 East 59 Street.
Yeah, I had a great time there a couple of times. I did a great play called Brownsville Bread, which was a one-woman show. Yes, that's a beautiful theater. That's a nice director's theater. It's so well kept and clean, and everything works. And the dressing rooms are great. The actors are well cared for. And then I did The Clearing there a number of years ago. For the first few years at the Neighborhood Playhouse, I was still running the schoolhouse. I felt I could do both, and I was going to do it, and it's okay. And I was all day at the school, get in the car, and all evening at the theater. And eventually, I did that for about 2.5 years. And then the school took over for me. Mainly because I really saw my mission. I did go home again and say that I will direct. Yes. And I did direct The Clearing, and I get offers sometimes, but my commitment to the school just grew and grew, and my commitment to young artists became more important to me than directing outside of there. So that just happened. But yeah, yeah, the 59 East 59th Street, wonderful, wonderful theater.
Nonprofit.
Yeah.
How did you get back to the Neighborhood Playhouse? Can you take me there when you went from Scholastic to going to the Neighborhood Playhouse, coming back home?
Yeah. Well, I used to, as you know, I felt an obligation to give back. So when I was running the Schoolhouse Theater in Westchester, which again, you know, it was a really lovely little equity house, and people, you know, we were very fortunate because you could be home in 50 minutes. So we could get people to come on up there and do a play and be home for, you know, by 11 o'clock. So it was a fun job for them, for actors. And I was able to entice people to come on up. But I would always call the Playhouse and use, you know, if I needed a young actor, I'd want to audition them. I often helped people get their equity card by being a stage manager for me. I just knew that when I had been a student, I wished there'd been a little more help in that regard. And now as the executive director, I do a lot of it, really, really help people get started in their career. But I did that. And so they were, you know, they were always coming up and helping. And, you know, at least a couple of times a year, I'd use a Playhouse person. And then I gave back. I stayed in touch. I came to see the showcases at the end of the year. And then, of course, you lose. And then Heather Randall, who we all know and love, I'm sure you know Heather, Tony Randall's widow, married to Tony Randall, one of our most illustrious grads. She and I worked on a benefit for the school. I believe it was the 75th birthday of the school. And it was at Tavern on the Green and all. So I was brought in the fold that way. And I so loved working with the board and with her and helping to sell those tickets and celebrate the school. And that was my first real active come on back instead of just send a check once in a while or meet a student for, you know, or help a student. I said, boy, so I got very interested in that. And Heather was very influential for bringing me on board. She puts the right people in the right place often and helps introduce a lot of people to other people and so on. So that started to happen. And I was invited to be on the board of directors, which I felt was an honor and really tried to be an active member. And then on it again, like the water seeking the crack, and it just kept happening. And I said, wow, this is right. This feels right. This feels terrific. And of course I was getting older myself. I didn't want to go out of town and didn't want to, you know, to seek a directing career away from the Schoolhouse would have meant also willing to go. So I don't know, things all happened. And it wasn't something that I ever would have said to you 30 years ago, this is where I would be, because I thought you went there for a while and then you left. I now understand how life works sometimes. What you said, it's so great, the bringing back around. And the giving back, I mean, I'm old enough, believe me, to understand. We all have to do that. And I love it. It feels so wonderful to mentor these actors, you know, and on their way. And at the Neighborhood Playhouse now, I have done a lot to what I said before, you know, bringing people back to the career. We have career development class. We bring in a lot of people, not only graduates, many more people to talk about this business, to talk about getting started. In the old days, that was really anathema. You weren't allowed to. It was kind of, now it seems crazy, but they were so pure about the lab, the work. And I don't say that slightly. It was serious work, the art of it. But you weren't allowed to bring into the same room anything about an agent or a manager or an audition. That was, and you have to. You have to help these young people. And you have to help them get a foot in the door and understand it and be the president of their own company, because that's who they are, you know? It's like, yeah, the run their LLC and make it happen. So yeah, I'm really good. I'm really proud of that, because it's helped the students. There's a lot of buzz about help, you know, that Sandy Faison, who you may know. Sandy Faison's a Broadway actress. She created the role of Grace Farrell in Annie in the original. She's a wonderful, wonderful actress who she teaches for me, but she ran the acting department at LaGuardia High School, the Fame High School, for many years, about 15 years. And again, she decided in her 50s, I think, to go back, and she wasn't going to act anymore. She wanted to go to school as an educator. Anyway, long story, she ended up at LaGuardia, which was wonderful for them. And then I kind of pulled her away and brought her back to the Playhouse a few years ago. where she just does a great job because she's a fabulous liaison to the business. She is a wonderful, she knows everyone, and everyone you mention her name to knows and loves her. And so there's a lot of, she's really opened the door and brings people over to talk to the students and brings her expertise in musical theater and all things to do with acting and art. So it's a great, she's a great addition and has helped me a lot. And again, we were dear friends when we were 20 years old, and here we all are. It's wild.
But in 2012, right, when you took over as artistic director, how did that happen? I mean, were you working at the Neighborhood Playhouse and then you were?
I was working hard at the schoolhouse still. And I was, yes, and I was being a director and I was doing a lot of cool things. I actually went to Ireland to do some research on a play and a writer that we thought we'd bring over, and we didn't. And it was in a very thoughtful, interesting place. And then my predecessor, Harold Baldridge, who was the executive director for a very long time, on the board. It was clear that it was time for Harold to begin to think about retiring. And we on the board were seeking and looking gently, as everyone was, about what will happen next. And, I'm not a big one on that it should all be an insider job. I mean, and I think that we're going through now. So with all of this opening the doors and realizing we have so much work to do in terms of equity and diversity. And it wasn't like they just pointed and clicked and stayed. It was that the Playhouse was in a particular position where someone coming on board to run it would have to really know it well at this point, because we were not, our reputation, it hadn't in any way soiled. It had just become quieter. People didn't really know whether we were there, we weren't there as much. Things had been a little bit, aggressive's not the right word. There wasn't as much word on the street about the school as there needed to be. And competition had really flared up. There's a lot of schools, conservatories, a lot of people putting plaques on the window and being acting teachers. Academia had really taken over. Enormous number of colleges were, in my day, that wasn't true. It wasn't. You went to the Neighborhood Playhouse or Juilliard, and that was it. And one was kind of high-end Shakespeare, and one was meat and potatoes New York acting. And so they were very different and also both very good. So anyway, we started examining. We talked to a number of people, and then it sort of just became that I would run it transitionally, perhaps that because I had these skills and I had run a theater and I was so passionate about the school, it seemed right, a good match for Harold to be able to retire and me to do this transitional taking over. And And I was the first woman to run the school since 1964. There had been no female Meisner acting teachers, and I'm not proud of it, but it's worth saying there weren't. There were only men teaching the work. I've brought on three women in my time here and trained, So it was time for change, but it was also time for transition into the change. And I was the right person to drive that bus for a while, and it turned into, 8.5 years now or 9 years, and I clearly was the right person at the right time. And again, there's that water seeking through the crack, and here I am. But I never would have thought, even when I was named the executive director, I think we all thought it would be for a few years. It would be, and there's nobody. There's no reason now. I mean, it's become my life's work in a big way. And we're doing this renovation, which I know a little bit about, just fantastic. We're making the building be the right home, and it should be in as good condition as the art that's going on with inside. It hadn't been that. It really had needed some real long overdue repairs that hadn't happened before I came on board. And I knew we have to bring this building up to the deserving quality the artists inside, do deserve. So that was another reason why it had to be someone who understood the history a little bit, and how are we going to get from there to here? So yeah, right. Yes. You know, all sort of, again, this word magical, you and I, it's wonderful when you can say that your life feels right.
How did you meet Michael Wilding? How did that happen?
He was a serious actor. We were in a class together. I forget which class. I think it was like a monologue class or something. And then he studied more. My husband, Fred Karaman, was an acting teacher. He was partners with Wynn Hanman at they had a studio in Carnegie Hall. Wynn and I were partners after my husband died. Sadly, Wynn was a graduate of the Playhouse and a teacher at the Playhouse for many, many years was Mr. Meisner. So I think it was then when we first met that he was in class there in Carnegie Hall, and his lovely wife, Brooke, who's still a dear friend today. They live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, or right outside of Santa Fe. They don't pursue acting anymore. Michael's a fantastic sculptor, believe it or not. Really cool, big, exciting sculptures where he wears like goggles and uses a tool, and they're cool. He's a very, very lovely guy, and I see them like once or twice a year when they come to New York. Unfortunately, I've never been there, and I should go because they're. But yeah, you meet a lot of people, don't you, Gerald? When you're here and you're open-hearted, and then you go and you people you'd never thought you'd dine with or share break bread with, I find that this, again, back to our word tribe, it's remarkable.
You're having an open house, right, at the Neighborhood Playhouse, right? A reading?
We're having a reading.
Do you want to talk about it? Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Because we made it through the pandemic, we did these enormous and necessary repairs and renovations, of which there are many more to do. You know, this is sort of phase one of what has to happen at the school. There needs to be physical improvements, and there needs to be money raised. We took the time, you know, once I saw that that we were going to be closed more than the 2 weeks we all thought we were going to be closed, I started thinking about how to use the time best in regards to that we're not going to be there. We're not going to have classes. They'll be online. What should we do? And we started, my very supportive board, unbelievable. They say yes a lot and they're just, I'm so thankful, agreed with me. And we decided to go ahead with these renovations. So they're complete now. We're open the doors. The students are back in person. They just were there last Monday. The 13th was the first day. All is going remarkably well. So I said, we need to have a celebration of this. And what would be, you know, and I started thinking about who we really are. It's a lot like your question with lightning strikes. This was kind of a lightning strikes thing too. Sanford Meisner directed Waiting for Lefty on Broadway in 1935. He co-directed it with Clifford Odets, but he was, you know, the real arm of the direction. And that was the group theater, you know, they became a force. And so I thought, okay, and I'm trying very hard to welcome more diverse people to the feast, to the table, both as teachers and as students, and reaching out and having very serious conversations with people who are helping us in this and facing our past, which, you know, was a man's club, you know, for years, a men's club, a white men's club, let's face it, in a way that that there are a lot of places were. So we've knocked down some walls. We have serious conversations. And Waiting for Lefty, directed by Meisner, is open to very great diversity in the casting of it from our students and our community. So I said, let's do this play. It's only a reading. We can't produce it per se because we're not ready yet. We're just right back into the building. We can't ever. So we invited some really wonderful graduates. Matt McCoy, he's a terrific actor, works all the time in Los Angeles. He's willing to come. He's reading a role. We're so thrilled. Younger people who've been on television lately and are coming up. I said, this is the play because it has 22 people in it, I think. Mm-hmm. And some of them are very small, non-speaking union members and so on. Great chance for our student actors who are recent graduates to jump on board. So we're so happy. We're having this event on Monday. Come in, have a little snack, all very, very COVID, you know, protocols, wear your mask, et cetera. the theater seats in about 100 people. We're not going to have more than probably 45 in the audience. And then read this wonderful play that's only an hour and 10 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And toast us again at the end, and just a passage for all that we've all been through, you know, all of us. I mean, not just the Playhouse, but I said, we got to do it our way. I mean, to me, Lefty was perfect. We don't need to go find some new play. We don't need to invent anything. We just went back, and I thought, you know what? Mr. Meisner directed this. Wow. You know, let's bring that to the front and do the kind of really, back to what you and I said earlier, that authentic, wonderful, serious acting, you know? Yeah. Yes, it's a reading, but believe me, they're going to blow the roof off the place, I'm sure of it, in the excitement.
Yeah. And the play is, it's such an apropos play because it's all about change.
Yeah, and it's all about injustice.
And injustice.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, a lot of wages and striking for better wages, and one can't help but think about Amazon and you know, should they unionize and all that. Those things are always there, but now we're not going to just keep on taking them for granted and say, oh, that's the way it is. No, it isn't. It shouldn't be. I really am not a hugely political person. I certainly know, but I don't want to use the school for that platform, but the art that's involved in, you know, and the voices that we can be heard. Yeah, it's meaningful. It's back to that word. Deep.
Yeah. Well, it's about humanity and stepping into yourself.
Yeah.
If I may say that about taking a risk in your life.
Great phrase. Great. Yeah. Taking a risk. Exactly. And I don't think I took enough, truthfully, as an old salty dog. Now I sometimes look back and think I didn't take enough risks. I'm not criticizing myself, but sometimes I wasn't bold enough. But the older you get, be bold. This is a bold move on the Playhouse to put the money into the renovation at a time when nobody even knows, you know. Yes, some Broadway shows are opening, please God, keep it going. But, you know, we're still all in the midst of this. And I say to the future, I'm not Pollyanna, you know, about it, but there will always be room for artists and actors. There will always be a need for people to tell stories and to help us all understand all this. And in fact, I tell the young students all the time, I mean, can you imagine what they've lived through? You know, these people who are, they're going to have stories to tell. You know, we've lived through it, but they're right on the cusp of their lives, and they're told to stay home for 18 months and sit in a room and be online. And so all these things are going to great stories are going to be told about it. So we're starting up, and I think the celebration on the 20th of the Waiting for Lefty will be such a great shot in the arm. And it's a huge, not to forget, what it also mainly is a huge thank you to the people who made it possible. They did say yes to me, and they did raise money, and you know, it's just another gift. I want to celebrate them.
Beautiful. I just want to go back with people might not realize that the Neighborhood Playhouse is really a conservatory. You can't just take one class or two classes, right?
No.
Can you talk about that?
I think with anything, there are a lot of people who do sometimes want to dabble or wonder, or they're attracted to the idea of acting, or they have a cousin and they think it's fun. And I'm all for that you can go take a class here and there and get your feet wet and enjoy it. But we all know, if you really want to do this with your life, if you want to commit to the world of art and be an actor professionally, like anything else, you know, you need a foundation. You need to know how to work. You need to be willing to work hard on your instrument. And again, your instrument is you, you know, and it's like a piano not tuned up. You have to be enormously tuned up, and you have to work hard to get into the best shape as an artist you can get. And I think that, you know, Mr. Meisner used to say it takes 20 years to make an actor. And what he meant by that was, you know, you can be here for two, and then you have to go work for 18 more before, and one day you're going to have a light bulb or lightning strikes moment. And when you realize, oh, this is what he was talking about, but you have to work and so on. And so we try to accomplish a lot in the 2 years, and I can't imagine doing it in less, But there is a difference between, enjoying it and wanting to do things like community theater or working in your local theater club or and saying, I want to do this with my life. I want the profession. I want to dig deep and I want to bring myself to the work. And that a conservatory is very different than a class here or there. And the task of putting the classes together and picking and choosing what you might take, that's very difficult. And then you're not with like-minded people. And another great thing about going to a conservatory is you're in your ensemble. You know, you're actually creating a world of that will become your network, of people that you'll know and people that you will help come along and you will share and collaborate. And so there's a lot of reasons to throw yourself in and fully study. And so beneficial if this is what you want to do, actually make a career of it. And it's really hard, everybody will say, to make money at this, quote unquote, but it isn't hard to make a living. And I don't think enough people remind the younger actors who want to do this, you can make a living. You won't have two cars in the garage and a swimming pool, perhaps, but you can put bread on the table for your family in this world. I mean, I spent a lot of time doing looping work on films, for instance, when I first got out. And I would be the voice of, the actor was now, the star was now in a different job, but they needed one line or one word in the bar scene and all. I'm sure you know what looping is. And I thought, this is a great gig. Put the headphones on and fill in. And I thought, wow, I'd rather do this than be working in a dentist office. I'm doing my thing, maybe, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of reason to encourage people to stay with it and find a way through. I mean, you are. Look at this. This is the coolest platform for young people to listen to and realize it is. And your questions are so worthy, like for people to think about.
Thank you. How do you see the school transforming in the next couple of years, 5 years, 10 years? What's your vision or fantasy for the school?
My vision is that we can hold on tight doing what we've always done so well, that the acting and the art within the building stays as solid and pure as it is. And even though the platforms in the world that we might be doing now more, you might be doing television, you might be doing, film, commercials, web series, these ways that the product might get to the audience have changed, but the training has not. Do you know what I mean? You still really need to be a fantastic rooted and facile actor in order to do anything that you get hired to do out there. And at a place at our school, at the Neighborhood Playhouse, you will be able to bring yourself to any text anyone gives you, even if it's playing on the moon and satellite. You know what I mean? The work is still the work, and not to forget that. So that I want to preserve and protect. I want to invite more people and work very hard to open the doors wider and to have a more diverse population and hear more voices. So that, the Meisner technique remains the Meisner technique, which is extraordinary. But as it's interpreted by different people, men, women, fluid gender, people of all colors, people of all nations, they bring themselves to it. And so it doesn't change, literally change, but of course the interpretation will, and we'll all be better for it. So I want that to happen. I want to welcome and seek out, help people come here. Financially, I really want to build a base of more support so that more people can come and may not have the means to come. Also may not have the means, we have a junior school on Saturdays and, we talk a lot about how are we going to get, just like you and I know, when I was young and I was able to know things and see, be told things or, read Jeeves and see P.G. Woodhouse, that's not always available to everyone. How do we help people, young people, find their creativity and find their voice? And I think the Playhouse should have and will have a stronger ability to do that. Even though we're the two-year conservatory, we do have, I think, an obligation to help younger people as well get to the arts and find us, and find places like us. I want very much for the building to continue to be improved and to be the little gem that it should be. I don't want to expand. I don't see us expanding enormously. I think the work is too unique and personal to get gigantic. We don't want to be a big university. We don't want to have buy another building. You know, we just want to sustain the work in this building. And I feel an obligation for the Playhouse to preserve the legacy. We'll also be ready, willing, and able to make necessary changes as the world changes, and be flexible and realize what a magnificent past we've had, and we will have a better future. I know it.
Well, Pamela, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was an honor. I so enjoyed it. I feel like we really met one another. That was so much fun and interesting. Thank you so much, Gerald.
It still happens every day when lightning strikes. It's the moment you know.
The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore, and the talent was booked by Anna Stratt.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.